This is Passing Judgment, a podcast about the law and how it affects you. I'm your host, Loyola Law School professor Jessica Levinson. Think of me as your personal law professor as we navigate the big legal questions of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers. So we're here with Kyle Chaney of Politico. And Kyle, thank you so much for coming back to Passing Judgment. You cover all of these legal questions that are indispensable in the sense of you are one of my go-to reporters for trying to figure out what is happening in this endless jigsaw puzzle that includes the former president and the legal hot water that he is in. So we're having this conversation on Thursday the 14th before we know whether or not District Attorney Fani Willis is disqualified in the Georgia case. There's an ongoing hearing in Florida in the Mar-a-Lago case. And I want to talk to you about something else you've written about, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. So, Kyle, thank you so much for coming back, passing judgment with us. I know your time is limited.
I am always happy to be with you, and I appreciate that, the kind introduction, and hope that in all that reporting, there's some clarity to provide, although I'm often at a loss in some of the chaos of it all, too.
Actually, what I love is that you provide clarity where something is clear, and where it's not, you are very honest about the fact that there's a question there or there's some confusion. And we'll talk about that specifically when we get to that big question of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, Colorado's unsuccessful attempt to say that the former president was not qualified for the ballot. But let's start with the news of this week, which is the Georgia case. So this is, of course, a state case that deals with election interference. The former president is one of the defendants, along with many other people who were involved in what I'm going to characterize as his efforts to thwart the peaceful transfer of power and undermine the election results. Can you remind us, Kyle, what was the news of this week when it comes to the Georgia case?
Sure. So the biggest news was that Judge Scott McAfee decided to dismiss six of the charges against three against Trump and some applied to his co-defendants. And all of those charges had to do with allegations that they tried to solicit Georgia officials to violate their oath of office. That's a statute on the books. But the judge said, look, there's hundreds, if not thousands, of ways you can violate your oath of office. You haven't really explained, D.A. Willis, which of those violations these defendants sought to solicit. And so because of that, that's fatal to the charges. They have to go. Now, that doesn't mean they're gone for good. You can refile those charges, put them back into the case, or you can appeal my ruling, and the DA has not, as of this taping, decided what to do.
And so the crux of the case remains, right? Those racketeering RICO charges, those weren't touched at all by this ruling. Is that right?
Right. And in a sense, the coverage sort of maybe underplayed that. Like, there's a centerpiece of the case is still intact. Now, there's a lot of challenges to that as well that the judge has not ruled on yet. But these are sort of on the margins. It's a sign. It's another challenge to this case, of which there have been many. And I think that's important. But it doesn't take away the heart of the case.
Well, and I think you're right. When I spoke about this yesterday, when the news broke, I really just tried to describe it as a blip. And specifically, as you noted, what we're talking about are charges that don't form the core or the heart of this case. And in fact, Judge McAfee, I read this as saying, I know that you specifically identified which oath was violated, and you have enough specificity with respect to overt acts that form this alleged conspiracy. So just go back and point to the specific provisions of the Georgia Constitution and the federal Constitution. So do you have a sense strategically if the prosecution is going to do this, or if they maybe feel like the time of going back to the grand jury just isn't worth it because the majority of the case is there?
You know, I don't have a clear read on that at the moment because, number one, the DA's office has been so mired in these other controversies that have been that it's hard to know how they view this case as it stands at all at the moment until we get clarity on whether the DA will continue to sit in this case. It's, you know, I think one thing, there was a lot of people reading the tea leaves on the judge's ruling in the sense that it's actually good for Fannie Willis, because why would he issue such a sort of focused and specific ruling if he was just about to throw her out of the case altogether, and we'd be back to the drawing board in a lot of ways. So maybe that's a sign that he's not going to disqualify her. But I think their office has been so focused on responding to these allegations of inappropriate conduct that they haven't, you know, given us any signals to read on the actual charges at issue. So we're still waiting for a sign from them.
So I think you're right. It's not clear that the district attorney will go back to the grand jury, try and re-add these charges. One thing I'm just thinking about is we keep saying the core of the case is still there. The racketeering charges are still there. Can you remind the audience exactly what we're talking about when we say the racketeering charges are still there?
This is the grand conspiracy charge that the Trump and 18 co-defendants, according to the DA, work together to effectuate essentially multiple plans to subvert the 2020 election in Georgia, to corrupt the outcome there. That's pressuring state legislators to do things improperly. It's sending false electors to Congress with false documentation. And then it's the harassment of Ruby Freeman to sort of foment this discredited claim of fraud that they use to try to justify or rationalize what they were asking those officials to do in Georgia and in Congress. So it's these multiple plots, essentially, with Trump at the head of all of them, that is the racketeering conspiracy, they've alleged.
And this is a charge that is typically used when it comes to organized crime. Is that still the case?
It is. And you know, I don't claim to be an expert on Georgia's particular racketeering statute, but I understand it's a, you know, can be used much more flexibly than in Georgia than it can in other states. So it's, you know, can catch a lot of different kinds of coordinated, organized activity, which in some ways the post-election stuff fits the bill.
And the district attorney has actually already used Georgia's, as you mentioned, fairly generous racketeering law in other areas, I believe in the area of education fraud, essentially, not related to organized crime. So we'll have to watch and see what happens with respect to the RICO charges. Obviously, again, the heart of the case. I'm wondering, because I'm assuming that the judge is not actually going to disqualify the district attorney, if you can talk about how and whether you think having the district attorney, Fannie Willis, continue, and or special prosecutor Nathan Wade continue, how that could affect the case and potentially the jury in a future trial.
I mean, like the publicity around these allegations that Willis and Wade had this inappropriate romantic relationship, and more importantly, that led to financial improprieties in terms of them benefiting from the sort of funding of the case and all that. That, you know, it's gotten saturation coverage, but I think there are ways to screen the jury for their sort of awareness and knowledge of that, as would be the, I mean, you can't have a case about Donald Trump where the jury hasn't heard something or other about Donald Trump. So there has to be ways to sort of account for that knowledge and ensure that there's not bias in that jury pool. But it's challenging, you know. I think Trump has one of the loudest megaphones in the world and has used it to sort of try to go after his prosecutor. If she remains on the case, I'm sure he won't stop doing that, and it will be, you know, certainly be in the backdrop. And you have these sort of parallel efforts in the state legislature and state to sort of, I think the governor just signed a law that would allow additional scrutiny of the way local prosecutors act and potentially be punished or sanctioned in certain ways that could even potentially disrupt this case. And so we haven't seen that yet, but it's possible. There's a lot of curveballs left to come before we ever get to trial here.
I wish we could stay in Georgia, but I know that people who are listening are going to want to know what is happening in Florida, because there is a hearing, as we said, that's going on as we're recording this episode, and it's based on two different motions to dismiss that were obviously brought by Trump. He wants this case thrown out. We're talking about the federal case in Georgia dealing with the alleged unlawful retention of documents at Mar-a-Lago. And the two motions to dismiss, as far as I read it, one is based on the Espionage Act and one is based on the Presidential Records Act. So I'm hoping you can help remind us, why does Trump think that the allegations related to the Espionage Act should be thrown out?
So his argument is that it's never been used in the way that it's been used in his case, that as a former president, he has a unique ability to retain classified information and even to designate it as his personal property, as he claims to have done, though we still haven't seen the evidence of that, at the tail end of his administration before sending the documents to Mar-a-Lago. So he just says that it's a statute that has not been applied in this way to a former president. And what I can tell you, and it won't be breaking at the time people hear this, but it is, as I'm understanding what's happening in that hearing, the judge does have questions about, is there any comparators or anything you can compare to the way this statute's being used against Donald Trump to anybody else in history, former VPs, former senior executive branch officials who handled classified material in a similar way, because otherwise, how could Trump have been on fair notice that he could be charged for his behavior if it had never been used that way? And so that seems to be the thrust of the initial conversation they're having in Florida.
Yeah, I read that argument as it's unconstitutionally vague because it's never been used this way, and therefore there are due process and separation of powers concerns. I know you can't weigh in with opinion. I'll just say that I'm not moved by any of the arguments that say this is the first time, because I can't remember a time when we've had allegations that a president has acted that way. So for me, this, well, we've never seen this before, actually, I think in some ways kind of cuts the other way and reminds us that we've never had a president behave this way. And so is the special prosecutor's argument here, well, Trump as chief executive should have been on notice, even though the Espionage Act has never been used exactly this way before, he certainly should have understood what was legal and not.
Well, I don't have visibility into what they're saying in court today, but I know they've argued, repeatedly that a lot of this has to do with the aggravating aspects of his, obstruction, and that actually provides evidence of the underlying crime, and what sets him apart and why he should have been, the effort to deceive the agency seeking to recover these materials, shows you that he knew what he was doing was wrong.
It seems like that's a similar argument to the one they're making with respect to the other motion to dismiss focused on the Presidential Records Act. And I read Trump's argument on that motion to dismiss to be some combination of, as president, I could say that anything was personal, and then kind of separate from that, and anyway, when it comes to the National Archives, it's inappropriate for there ever to be a criminal proceeding because they deal with civil violations. I'm not sure that either one of those arguments to me passes a straight-faced test, but am I missing something here in terms of what his arguments are?
Not really, and I think that's the point that Smith keeps making is the PRA doesn't say anything about classified information. There are a whole separate set of laws about handling. So even if you assumed everything they said about the Presidential Records Act was true, and they don't assume that, you still have to account for the fact that he's violated multiple laws allegedly about classified information and how that's a separate procedures for doing that appropriately. And so they say it's sort of beside the point. Never mind, they point out that there's just no evidence that he took any steps under the PRA to make these records his personal property. And I think Trump's people argue, well, just the sheer act of sending the documents to Mar-a-Lago in the final days of his presidency shows you he wanted them to be his personal property. And, I guess the judge is going to have to weigh that. But they say that's preposterous because, that's never worked like that before.
I just find this one kind of befuddling for the reasons that you talked about, that whether or not a document is classified is different from whether or not it's personal, and willful retention of documents that seemingly quite clearly belong to the public, not to Donald Trump as a person, can of course lead to criminal charges. So particularly on the motion to dismiss phase, I'm just not seeing this one. Is there anything that we expect to happen with respect to the scheduling of this particular case? It feels to me like this is the case where, based on Judge Cannon's embrace, seemingly, of Trump's argument that delays are needed for a variety of different reasons, that we're not going to see a trial before the election.
You know, it's tricky. And again, my read from the early part of the court hearings is that she, and what I've been relayed to by my colleagues in the room, is she hasn't said a word about, not one hint, not a wink or nod of any kind about what she's going to do with the schedule. We may, by the time people hear this, we may have a schedule that she lays out, but she gave no sense of whether she's embracing what Trump wants, which is pushes till after the election. Trump's backup option is moved to August. Special counsel wants it in early July, and she's kind of hinted she's skeptical of that at the last hearing they had. So I suspect she's moving toward maybe an August timeline, but also, you know, she may just totally go in with Trump and decide to push this after the election, which, in a weird way, it's hard to know what the better outcome for Trump is, because you have the potential that the Washington, D.C. case could end up on the calendar in the summer then, which is, we know, he also does not want to happen. But the judge there seems more motivated to do it this year, whereas, you know, Judge Cannon doesn't seem in a hurry.
And you're, of course, talking about the other federal criminal case pending against the former president. That's the D.C. interference case, the election interference case out of D.C., with some factual and legal overlaps to the Georgia case that we were talking about. That's the case being overseen by Judge Chutkan. And, of course, for that case, we're actually waiting on the Supreme Court, as far as I can see, in actually two different decisions. One is this question of whether or not presidents enjoy absolute or qualified immunity from criminal prosecution based on official acts. But the other is actually a separate case not involving Trump, but which asks whether or not one of the statutes that he's charged under is an appropriate statute to use when it comes to the events of January 6th. Is that about what we're waiting for when it comes to that DC interference case?
Yes. I mean, they can't move forward. Now, the obstruction charge that you referenced, that whether it can even be applied to Donald Trump, you know, the prosecutors haven't given any indication one way or the other how they plan to account for that whenever the ruling comes down. But they can't move their case forward anyway until the immunity question is resolved. And now, actually, the timing almost lines up where you may have a ruling on both of those issues around the same time, which will then tell us whether Jack Smith can move forward with a smaller trial, whether he gets to move forward as planned just a little later, or whether the case gets thrown out altogether because of the immunity question. And so there's a lot riding on that. The Supreme Court, of course, everything is riding on it. But the main question still is how quickly and do they rule, and will they allow the trial to proceed in some form or another?
Kyle, I have a theory about the immunity case that I'm hoping you can weigh in on as we move to the other big Supreme Court case dealing with Section 3. But my feeling about the immunity case pending before the court, again, oral argument set for April 25th, Thursday. I think it's hard to believe we would get an opinion much before what's typically the end of the term, which is June 30th, that based on the question presented in the case, which is, I'm paraphrasing, but some version of, we're going to decide whether presidents have absolute or qualified immunity when it comes to criminal prosecutions for official acts, that there's a chance that they say, we're creating this new standard of qualified immunity. Now Judge Chutkan can go back and determine whether or not and to what extent it applies to the former president. That would cause an additional delay. Is that right? As she then goes back to the complaint and looks back at this new hypothetical standard of qualified immunity.
That's one possible outcome. And in fact, one of the judges in the appeals court floated that during the oral arguments, although that's not how they ruled, but one of the judges floated, maybe Judge Chutkan has to decide what were Trump's acts official acts of the presidency or the political acts, and is there, you know, define, you know, as they're laid out in the indictment, sort of look at those acts. And even the prosecutor said, if you go to that analysis, it is a little more nuanced. But we don't think the immunity exists at all for a former president, and therefore, you know, we don't have to get there. The Supreme Court could get there and make this slower and more onerous to put back on a trial timeline. But I think that's a good question. I just don't know if that'll be a ruling that they'd be happy with, in the sense that it means the case doesn't get thrown out altogether. DOJ has embraced kind of qualified immunity thing in other contexts, you know, in the civil context for former officials. So maybe it sort of aligns with the department's position in the past. Well, and I would think, you know, the executive privilege is a good analogy here, where you have, you know, Supreme Court precedent that says former presidents do get it, but it is limited and it doesn't outweigh the current executive's prerogatives and it wanes over time. That seems like a standard I could see, you know, for immunity from criminal side as well.
Right, because we are again talking about a matter of first impression. We've never been here before. We've never had a reason to have this conversation. Speaking of which, we've never had a situation where a state looking at Section 3 of the 14th Amendment has said, we're looking at a former president and we think he's disqualified from being president again. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment, as people who listen to the podcast know, essentially says if you served in certain offices before and you engage in an insurrection, then you can't serve in certain offices next. You're not eligible. And Colorado, along with the Secretary of State of Maine — for Colorado, it was the Supreme Court. For Maine, it was the Secretary of State — said, we're looking at the former president, we're looking at what happened on January 6th, and we think that Section 3 means that he's disqualified. The Supreme Court, of course, disagreed in a unanimous but totally fractured decision, which I know how that sounds. Can you remind us of where there was agreement? So there was — it wasn't just a veneer of a unanimous conclusion. There was actually unanimity, but it was fairly narrow, actually.
On one very specific point, which is that states don't get to determine whether someone is eligible or disqualified, under Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And that's where the unanimity stops.
And why not? I mean, states control ballot access to a great extent. Every state has slightly different ballot access rules. Can you remind listeners, like, what's the fear in saying Colorado, go ahead, Maine, go ahead, Michigan, if you can, go ahead?
Because then you end up with different states with different processes, different standards of evidence, coming to completely different conclusions, which could totally disjoint, you know, a national, a federal election, which, you know, in some ways, states do have that authority in a sense, in that they — some states can have electors apportioned by congressional district and do, and other states don't. And there is a sort of a disjointedness to it that's by design to give states that power. But what the justices seemed to agree on was that the 14th Amendment was meant to constrain certain aspects of state power to prevent things, discrimination, this is post-Civil War. And so in that sense, using that to then actually enhance state power to throw out federal candidates, you could have had, you know, Confederate states deciding that someone was ineligible for office under those same principles, according to, you know, what the justices were concerned about. And so I think that their view of what the 14th Amendment was supposed to do was the opposite of what Colorado actually did.
And I just taught this case in my constitutional law class last night, and we talked about those big questions of basically who has the power, who decides, and what seemed to be the fear of all nine justices of we can't create, and they kept using these words, a chaotic patchwork, right? We can't say, Colorado, you make one decision, Alabama, you make another. But as you noted, that's where the disagreement ended. And this is where I'm hoping you can help us understand exactly what the confusion or chaos is, because I do think there are a bunch of unanswered questions here. Sure. I'll just simply say, and then I'll let you take it, that the per curiam kind of went on to say either the only way or one way to enforce Section 3 of the 14th Amendment is by congressional legislation, and a specific type of congressional legislation. The concurrence from the liberal justices, which reads like a dissent and apparently was intended to be a dissent in part, says all we needed to decide is, does Colorado have the power? So now why are you talking about Congress and their power? And there are these scary things at the end of the road that by answering a question not asked of us, we are now potentially creating kind of more problems. So Could you pick it up from there in terms of what's the disagreement about what the per curiam actually said, and what specifically is the concurrence worried about here?
So the issue is that, I mean, what the concurring slash dissenting justices seemed worried about was that the majority opinion effectively said the only way to disqualify someone is through Congress. Like, only Congress can decide whether a candidate for federal office is disqualified under the 14th Amendment. And that was not really, there's some disagreement about whether that should be the outcome and whether that was even something they needed to decide. But if you read the opinion itself, it's a little bit more ambiguous than that about whether the justices really did say that. In the majority opinion. And so it's led to all kinds of questions about, was there some give and take there? Was there some negotiating about what the contours of the per curiam decision were going to be that ultimately weren't reflected in the concurring opinion? So it's hard. It's a little bit ambiguous. And I read this as someone who has sort of lived in, you know, the post January 6th world and said, I just see what this is going to, the kind of chaos this is going to create in Congress, where there's some interpretation that, yeah, you need legislation to say who's disqualified, but I can see a lot of members of Congress looking at that, the ruling, and saying, it's up to us to decide whether Donald Trump is an insurrectionist. And if we think he is, how can we in good conscience count electors that have been appointed for him as an ineligible candidate for office? And if they decide to do that, you've got another chaotic January 6th on our hands, especially in the spotlight, the heat of that political moment, where there's going to be so much focus on that day. And you're certainly going to have allegations of election. You know, Trump will be out there saying they're trying to take the election from us, you know, whether he wins or loses. You know, it seems inevitable that we're going to be on this collision course again that ends on January 6th. And I think the justices probably wanted to avoid that, but in a way may have made that likelier.
And that's what I found when the opinion first came out and we're all reading it very carefully. You have all of this concern from the liberal justices in the concurrence of, you are protecting a future insurrectionist. You're protecting the former president of the United States. And they didn't specifically say what you said now, which has to be the answer, right? Which is, we're worried about, and I don't remember exactly which day in January 2025 it is, but we're worried that in January 2025, when we're supposed to meet to certify the Electoral College vote, that there's going to be some problem about what power we as members of Congress have. And you said something I think that hasn't been understood very well before we started taping, and maybe we can end the episode with this, which is, it's not just if the former president, if Trump gets more Electoral College votes, it's potentially also if he gets fewer Electoral College votes on election night. So how could this play out?
I mean, look, January 6th, 2025, there'll be a new Congress sitting, could be a Democratic-led Congress, and they will have, you know, that Congress might believe that Trump is, you know, ineligible for office, and whereas this Congress, the Republican-led Congress, might disagree. But they only have 3 days to consider that question in a new Congress before they have to start counting electoral votes. And, you know, I can't envision a scenario where there's not some major question, even if it's driven by politics or by thoughtful analysis, about whether any Congress should count the electoral votes of someone they consider ineligible for the presidency. And so again, win or lose, Trump was going to get some electors, in the states that he wins, and they will have to make a decision as, do we count these votes or not? And that'll be a question for the next Congress to answer.
Kyle, that was the clearest description I've heard so far on what the potential chaos that we're worried about is. So I think that's a perfect place to leave the episode. Hopefully for the listeners who are wondering, what is it that the concurrence is really worried about? Now we know exactly what it is. So Kyle Chaney of Politico, thank you for being a repeat player and coming back on Passing Judgment.
I'm always happy to be with you. It's always a great conversation.
And again, I read your pieces all the time. They're indispensable to me, and I know they are to the listeners as well. So we're going to wish everybody a great day. Please, as always, rate, review, and subscribe, and we'll bring more of these conversations to you in the coming weeks.